I'm wearing a t-shirt that says love fighting, hate violence. I do love fighting. And I suppose when it's posed in that way, I also hate violence. And one of the originators of this slogan is Dr. Alex Channon, who is a senior lecturer in, is it sport and what, sports studies, or how is it? How, what's your title, Alex?
Technically, it's physical education and sports studies.
Physical education and
Yeah.
sports studies. And how come I'm wearing this cool t-shirt that says love fighting, hate violence?
You're wearing it because I think, did you buy it for Christmas? Was that a thing that you
Well, no, you gave one to me. This is the one you gave to me, and I
Right,
did
I get
buy
you.
one. I bought one for my daughter for Christmas because
Yeah.
she thought it was so cool that I did actually buy one for her, yes.
Wicked. Yeah, well, love fighting hate violence. I suppose, yeah, we can start talking about that. That's a project that I think a few people following the podcast might have heard of before, in the martial arts studies sort of world, as it were. It's a project that I've developed with my colleague Chris Matthews, who's at Nottingham Trent. We started this about 4 years ago now, I want to say, about 2016, I think, was when we kicked things off. The idea being, it's I'm sure we'll spend a little bit of time today talking about this sort of fighting violence. What's the difference, and how can you call fighting non-violent, and so on. Theoretically, we've been doing research on martial arts, both of us, in slightly different projects for a while, and we've both grappled with this idea to some extent, and with interviewing people and observing training practices, that people generally observe the difference between what happens in a martial arts context when you punch people, and what happens outside of that context. So we were thinking about that theoretically, academically, and one of the things that we sort of learned through that process was that there's something going on in martial arts that gives people a kind of an appreciation of where violence begins and ends. And if we can try to use that knowledge, that sort of tacit embodied understanding about where the limits of violence lie, maybe we can use martial arts activities to educate people, young people in particular, about violence. So it's often said that martial arts helps us to stop bullying, it builds self-confidence, it can be empowering. All of these kind of claims are made about martial arts. And we were thinking, how can we sort of specifically work towards that, right? Rather than just assuming that those lessons are learned in any context, what can we do to sort of try and, deliberately work towards that? So it's kind of a, I guess if you wanted to describe Love Fighting Hate Violence, it's sort of a, a pedagogical project, or a coaching-based project, or at least it's turning into that now, where we're trying to use martial arts activities to sort of get towards that point where we think, okay, what we're doing now is okay, but if we do the same thing outside of this context, it's not okay. What is it in the now that makes it okay, and how can we learn from that and apply that to other parts of our life? Basically, we're talking about consent, right? It's a key principle for us. So Love Fighting Hate Violence is a project all about trying to bring that process of how consent is established and formed, sort of bring it to the forefront and use it to use martial arts to teach people about how to recognize that elsewhere in their lives.
Okay, so you said that you start from a position of feeling that people who practice martial arts or combat sports have a kind of intuition that is a result of the training that enables them to kind of tacitly just understand when something, so I'm guess you're saying like we're sparring, we're training together, or even we're competing. And I can hit you a certain way, a certain number of times, or throw you, and you can go, fair enough. But then maybe you could sense when I'm becoming violent, maybe when I'm becoming, when there's just a tacit transgression of something that changes a combat exercise, a combat exchange into something violent. Is that kind of what you're saying?
That's part of it, yeah. I think a really nice way to think about this for people who practice martial arts is next time you're sparring or running through a technique, and I'll use an example that really struck me from my own practice when I started BJJ about a year and a half ago. We were learning a rear naked choke, and obviously a rear naked choke involves squeezing somebody's throat quite uncomfortably. It's quite painful, it doesn't feel particularly nice, and if you don't let go of it, then they pass out, right? And in competition, it's legitimate to do that. Obviously, not when you're just learning, but that's the technique. That's what it's for. And my partner and I, we're taking it in turns to do this move to each other, and we're experiencing pain, certainly, and it's a very unpleasant sensation to be put in that hold. But each time we do it, we're not apologising to each other. We're just going through it. We're going through the motions. Now, it happened that I was trying to do this technique and sliding my hand across the back of my partner's head. To lock it in, and he's got long hair done up in a bun, and my hand gets caught in his hair, and I'm pulling the guy's hair. And instantly I let go. Like, oh, sorry, mate, you're right, sorry. Like, I've got no moral problem. There's no issue there. There's no feeling that there's something wrong with choking this person.
Yeah.
But there is with pulling his hair. And I think we can all imagine or remember times when in our training we've made that little step outside of what we're supposed to do, even if the actual physical damage is far less than what you're trying to do to each other. You recognise that as wrong, and you need to redress that. So, you know, that's like a little hint, right? It's not the whole, you know, sum total of figuring out violence, but it's a little hint that when we agree to do something, it's not problematic for us. In fact, I want you to try and do it to me, you know, otherwise the training doesn't make sense. But when we do something that we don't expect, we haven't explicitly consented to, then, you know, that's problematic, whether that's in a, you know, in a sparring situation or a competition or elsewhere.
Okay. And you also, I mean, you've expanded this, haven't you? If I share this screen, I share this one, you should be able to see it. The Love Fighting Hate Violence website. It's got a blog, it's got a manifesto. Tell us about the manifesto. What's the Love Fighting Hate Violence manifesto?
Okay, yeah. So if you go on the website there, lfhv.org, you should be able to find that. We've had it translated into a few different languages. By some of our supporters and colleagues, which is lovely. The LFHV manifesto is a short read. It should break down just the general outline of what we're talking about here, the sort of core ideas behind the campaign, the project as it is. Some of it is a little bit theoretical, but it's deliberately not sort of really academic to try and make it a bit more accessible to folk whose interest is not squarely in the, you know, the sort of theoretical side of things, but more sort of applied. So. It's a short run through of the ideas that we're just sort of running down here. Should be relatively easy to read. And if anybody wants to request a hard copy, I've got a box of them. So by all means.
Okay. And so in terms of your own history, I mean, one of your, I think, big early-ish publications was a big edited collection on, was it Women in Combat Sports or Gender in Combat Sports? Big Routledge thing, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's a Palgrave book. The full title was Global Perspectives on Women Warriors Around the World. So Global Perspectives on Women in Combat Sports, Women Warriors Around the World. They made us reverse that cool title and subtitle because they thought it would be better for search engine optimization. So Global Perspectives it is. It was an edited collection of essays on boxing, jiu-jitsu, pro wrestling, had an essay on that in there, self-defense practice, karate, a whole bunch of different martial arts practices written about from scholars working in different parts of the world. We didn't cover the whole world. Obviously, I think it's one thing you can always count on a collection that says global in the title to not really be that global. But there's a fair few different case studies in there. They're all about women's engagement in martial arts and combat sports, largely informed by a sort of gender studies frame.
So did you start in gender studies, or is this just something that really animated you at a certain point?
Yeah, so my PhD was in was a gender studies, sociological gender studies piece on men and women who train together in martial arts. So looking at the sort of interactional dynamics and relationships that form, how it impacts on people's understanding of gender, propriety and identity and so on. So that's really what got me started actually in martial arts studies, was writing about gender and its many manifestations through the actual practice of martial arts. Did a couple of small papers on like media-based studies of how gender is represented in combat sport media. And this book project, again with Chris Matthews, he and I have done quite a bit of work together, sort of came together quite nicely at a time when we initially put the plan together when the UFC announced that they'd be opening a women's division in 2012. So it was around the time, again, with the London Olympics, we had women's boxing in the Olympics. There was quite a lot of attention on this growth of women in combat sports. So it seemed a timely sort of moment, and we pulled it together.
So what was your kind of overarching argument then in your PhD research, and how did you show or prove or find out or explore the issues of the issues that you explored?
Yeah, so it was a sociological study. The method was based around semi-structured interviewing and sort of loosely informed also by participant observations, although in the end, that's the majority of the data came through the interview on that. And the research question overall was I was quite into feminist theory at that time, and it was this notion, you know, in most critical theory of, you know, these big structures of power that exist, and how can we challenge those, and how do people find their way through them and try and subvert them and resist the control they have over our lives. So the research question was really animated by that kind of epistemology. It was around in what ways does or can martial arts practice subvert gender?
Okay.
As we understand it from that point of view, that sort of monolithic, hegemonic masculinity, patriarchy sort of view on gender, and what do we do in martial arts that maybe challenges that at the same time as it perhaps conforms to. The overall conclusions, more or less what you'd expect, I think, if you're familiar with this area of research, that in some cases it does and in some cases it doesn't. It depends on context, it depends on individual people. Mm. But certainly there are moments in martial arts practice when we have men and women together in a sport setting, which is pretty rare anyway. You know, beyond martial arts, it's not that common for men and women to train at the same time in a lot of sports that involve physical contact. So yeah, in certain conditions, in those sort of environments, there are possibilities for people to really grapple with, you know, what it means to be masculine, feminine, and the traditional ways that we think about gender, and to work through those, and in some cases, to be quite critical of them.
But this feeds into your something that you developed more recently, isn't it? Which is a kind of coaching toolkit and how to build inclusive training environments for different genders, I guess, different abilities, different ethnicities, I guess. It's there's a lot of questions that you suggest that coaches and instructors should really rigorously engage with in order to try and develop inclusive spaces that maybe don't reproduce kind of sexism or racism or ableism or anything like that. Is that right?
Yeah, so I think the piece you're referring to is it's a paper forthcoming in an edited text. I think it's due for publication this year. If it was.
I was thinking of the workshop that you did a year or two ago, a couple of years ago. You did something, right. And I wanted to go, but I just wasn't able to go. But you sent me a lot of the information about it, and you were talking about those kinds of things there.
That might have been the Love, Fighting, Hate, Violence one, which was to do more with this sort of teaching consent and respect, you know, through martial arts, and it. Inclusion is part of that, but it wasn't explicitly focused around that. The piece that I've got currently and it's waiting publication is loosely derived from the event that you were at a few years back in Eastbourne, where we did talk about, you know, making training environments more welcoming for particularly for women and girls at that point. Mm. And I think we also had a discussion, Anna and Catherine, Catherine Phipps, Anna Kavura, spoke about LGBT inclusion in martial arts then. That's sort of a strand of what I've done in the past. If folk are interested in that, you better find that paper. It's written with Catherine, actually, with Catherine Phipps and with Anastasia Homotova about making what are often male-dominated, numerically male-dominated environments, which naturally, let's say, lends itself sometimes to being sort of masculine atmospheres of martial arts gyms. What kind of things coaches can do to, you know, firstly recognize the ways in which, you know, this sort of masculine atmosphere might be daunting or intimidating to some women, and then how they might be able to, you know, go about sort of addressing that and making their training environments more welcoming. It's a question that I think, you know, we see a lot of this sort of gender stuff in you know, on social media and in sort of pop science debates about, you know, feminism and inclusion and whatnot. And the idea that I think circulates often in these kind of discussions is that there's something about male sports culture that's sort of under attack, you know, from the feminist lefties who want to change everything and make everything, you know, cuddly and warm and so on. These kind of arguments, I think it's really important to get ahead of them and say, look, this isn't really what's going on here. This isn't about transforming these sports into something unrecognizable. It's about taking a moment to, you know, if you're a bloke, if you're a man, if you're a heterosexual man, these kind of sporting enclaves, these environments, they've existed in the way that they have for many, many years, run by people just like you, replicating, you know, the interests that people like you have. And, you know, you don't really have to worry too much about them. You can go to these places and you can be pretty much guaranteed that you're going to fit in there. Mm-hmm. So long as you know, you're there for the reasons that everybody else is. Whereas taking a moment to empathize with people who don't fit into that category, you know, they're stepping into an environment which historically has not been run by people like them and hasn't, you know, resonated closely with the things that they're told they should be interested in. So you're starting from a default position of being an outsider, either in your own mind or in potentially in the minds of the people in that space. So really what we're trying to do here is not, you know, suggest that you have to completely overhaul everything about martial arts and reinvent it in a kind of, you know, colour it pink, for instance, and it'll all be fine. You know, it's about empathy, really. It's about making that sort of step to have a human connection with somebody who's different to yourself and think about the ways that you can try and include them. You know, in the end, you're looking at more people joining your gyms, you're looking at a more diverse crowd and exchange of ideas from people of different backgrounds and so on. In my view, only a positive thing when it's taken seriously and done properly. So that's kind of really what we were saying in that particular piece. It's sort of a call to address inclusion as something that's in everyone's interests and outlining a few ways that we might go about doing that.
Okay. And you also, you teach at undergraduate level and I guess probably also at postgraduate level. And I mean, do you factor martial arts issues into your teaching? But I guess you teach a broad range of kind of physical education type subjects, but how big a part do martial arts play in that?
Yeah, it's something that a lot of the PE students that I encounter, they're either interested in as an alternative activity, which is a big thing for us, our PE program. We like to encourage students to think outside the box of the usual diet of activities that they had, that their parents probably had, their teachers had. Mm-hmm. For folks from outside the UK who are following this podcast, it's usually football, you know, soccer, that is, rugby, cricket, and athletics. With a bit of swimming and dance thrown in as well sometimes. Yeah. So trying to get, you know, trainee PE teachers to think outside that box about, you know, what else can we do that can count as physical education? You know, I want to educate somebody through the physical medium. There are many, many things that we can do that give a more diverse, and, you know, we would say a richer introduction to, you know, human movement and learning about your own body and your own self through that medium. So within that general paradigm, my colleagues at Brighton have been very, supportive and very enthusiastic for including martial arts activities within the within the lineup of stuff that we get the students to do. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I developed a martial arts module that's been running. It would have been in its fourth year this year, but for reasons I'll circle back to in a minute, it didn't run. So it ran for 3 years with a mix of sort of theoretical stuff with some practicals. Practicals mostly oriented towards teaching styles, approaches to pedagogy and so on.
Okay.
Physical literacy for those who are PE nuts who are following this. And then the theoretical stuff was largely informed by what we've been doing, by martial arts studies. So it's been nice to work through that and, you know, get a chance to teach that in the undergrad curriculum.
Yeah, it's funny because now that we're on lockdown and my daughters are at secondary school and they're getting, you know, they're getting homework sent as schoolwork, and the PE stuff is 9 times out of 10, their PE stuff is follow this white belt taekwondo class online. Or I just looked there before and my youngest daughter, she was looking at her screen. I was like, oh, what's this about boxing? And she was like, do this boxing work. And I was like, come on, then let's do it. And she said, no, because I was making her lift weights yesterday. So I'm turning her into an Olympic weightlifter while she's on lockdown. But they would never do that in the classroom. They weren't doing that before lockdown, but now that it's lockdown, it's like everyone learned this taekwondo kata or something, this taekwondo pattern. It's interesting, isn't it, the way that the PE syllabus is kind of, it has to broaden out when they can't do team sports and they go, well, what else would it be? And then martial arts and combat sports pop up again.
Yeah, I think when you're working through kata or you're doing a bit of shadow boxing, it's something you can happily do in a small confined space, right? And there's without the potential, I mean, this is one of the reasons I think we don't see it a lot in schools in the UK, is the potential for people to get hurt while doing it, and then that reflects really badly because, oh my God, you know, it's violence, and we're teaching our children to be good at violence, which, you know what I think about that, but that's the discourse, isn't it? That's the general impression. I think, you know, we do see actually in PE, we do see martial arts activities here and there, and if you look at the current national curriculum, so I always chuckle a little bit when I see these petitions going around about put martial arts on the curriculum.
I shared one, didn't I? And you commented and said it's on anyway.
You can do it, right? You can do it. In fact, that was the one that you shared you were right in that. It was right in that it's to do with the examinable activities at the accredited PE, so that's GCSE and beyond. And currently there isn't, I don't think, an option to do that as, you know, for your exams. So But yeah, for younger kids, there's nothing stopping a teacher from using a martial arts activity, you know, doing a unit on, you know, judo in order to teach outwitting an opponent, for instance. So if you're meeting a curriculum goal, you can use a martial arts activity to do that.
Okay.
And that's really where I'm at with this module, is giving students an opportunity to be exposed to these activities and say, look, you don't need to be a black belt to understand that you can do this activity and that activity in order to get children to meet that learning outcome.
Yeah.
You know, but because it's something that in a lot of people's minds, you know, you've got this sort of esoteric, mystical knowledge that if you're not, you know, an old man on a mountain, you couldn't teach Kung Fu. You know, it's that kind of attitude, I think, combined with the fears over violence that makes it, you know, particularly newly qualified teachers aren't going to go near it if they don't have that baseline confidence to, you know, to show them that it's possible to do, you know, simple box exercise stuff, just to get kids, you know, taste of this, you know.
It's a tricky one, isn't it? Because the question of violence comes back there. When, I mean, I've been asked to show people down the school or Cubs or Scouts, or can you come and show us? I'm like, but basically what I can do is show people how to damage each other. Are you sure you want me to do that? Yeah. It's a tricky one, because it's like, on one set, within the proper parameters, and if you can organize it and structure it properly, then it's about skill and discipline and coordination, everything. But if I just go into a classroom and say, okay, this is a jab, this is a cross, this is a kick, they're going to start battering each other.
Yeah. And this, I mean, I would always put this back into the PE context. This is why PE is so important, that we study PE properly, right? Because you've got someone who's good at doing an activity. You know, you've been training martial arts for most of your life, right? You're good at it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you could create a PE lesson that's useful for year five kids, you know, those young ages, to learn what they need to learn through the medium of this. So yeah, this isn't about let's just get martial arts in the PE curriculum. It's about let's give PE teachers the resource to use this to do their job. So that's kind of, you know, in terms of the ethos of how we're looking at PE at the University of Brighton, it's very much protect the professional status of this discipline, protect the academic integrity of the education they're getting, the training teachers, and give them a wide range of different activities, of which, you know, martial arts is one. We also have a whole bunch of other stuff.
And what do you think about the kind of the changing status of kind of embodied physical activities, like, you know, solo martial arts practice or yoga, or maybe even dance, and you know, in the lockdown, in the context of now, we seem to be valuing publicly things that we would kind of have scoffed at 3 months ago about the importance of, maybe, you know, artwork or of exercise or of stretching or whatever. I mean, have you been following the changes in the public statements here and there about exercise and well-being?
Not on an academic level. I couldn't tell you, you know, with sort of confidence analytically that this is, you know, new or that's changed or whatever. As a person who is part of that process, though, I think my attitude towards watching, BJJ tutorials on YouTube and then trying to replicate them somehow, you know, has been, I've seen value in something that, yeah, like you say, previously you wouldn't have given the time of day. Doing yoga as well. I've done quite a bit of yoga in the, in the sunroom out down by the garden, which has been really pleasant.
You know, and I guess the one thing that you can't get with the solo, well, you probably can, but one thing it's more difficult to get with the solo practice is something that you were discussing in terms in your last, one of your recent journal article publications in martial arts studies, concept of edge work, of taking things, how far can you take this thing, how far? So that's something, and your edge work is a concept that was developed not in martial arts studies, but you're applying it to thinking about what are we after when we're after this. Why do we want to fight? Why do we want to test ourselves? Could you tell us a bit about edge work as a concept?
Okay, yeah, edge work is it's initially developed by the journalist Hunter S. Thompson, which folks might be familiar with for, you know, being a world famous journalist. But it was used by Stephen Ling, who's a social psychologist and a sociologist. From sort of the late 1980s on, he started writing about this idea that people engage in edge work, which is a calculated engagement with an extreme risk, where you approach, it's quite important, this notion of boundaries. You approach a boundary between life and death, for instance, or sanity and insanity. And the purpose of doing this, of taking this massive risk and of approaching that edge, is to test your own ability to remain in control. Mm. It's absolutely essential. It's not just about risk taking, it's about taking a calculated risk that gives you a chance to demonstrate to yourself that you can stay in control under the most stressful or testing or, you know, otherwise challenging conditions. So the paper that I wrote for martial arts studies was looking at how we might think of mixed martial arts as a kind of edge work. Mm-hmm. That people involved in mixed martial arts are pushing themselves beyond what most martial artists would engage in. They're pushing themselves to a point where, you know, you can be attacked in pretty much any way within the bounds of rules, but it vastly expands on the possibilities in a boxing match, for instance, or in a, you know, semi-contact kickboxing tournament. You are taking quite profound risks with your health when you cut weight, for instance, and cutting weight is about self-mastery. You know, you're really placing high premium on your ability to not lose your head when someone else is trying to take it off. You know, when you've got someone sat on top of you, and you probably know this from the early BJJ lessons, the whole don't tap to pressure thing, right? This is about learning that when someone's suffocating you and they're squashing your ribs and their horrible sweaty belly is in your face, you know, you're actually fine. You're not going to die, right? You hang in there, believe in yourself, and the ability to come through those moments. Yeah. Is what we're testing.
That's the worst. I was talking to Darren Kelsey a few weeks ago, and it's like that was the most horrific thing. The realization that I'm so claustrophobic. Yeah. I don't mind feeling a rear naked choke sliding on, and you go, okay, I'm going to tap in a second. It's when you can't get an airway because someone's suffocating you like a huge cushion or a pillow. It's like, and you just panic.
Yeah.
I just hate that.
And it's so humiliating, isn't it? Because you know that you shouldn't tap, and they know that you shouldn't tap.
Yeah. Why have you tapped? I'm like, ah.
Have my arm.
Because you stink. You stink. That's why I've tapped.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's those experiences that, you know, in terms of your everyday life, and correct me if I'm wrong, but most things that you do in your daily life don't involve that kind of experience, right? And certainly not for me. You know, you don't come that close to these real gut check moments. You know, your chips are down. There's nobody else that you can rely on. There's no other sort of recourse. It's either do or die. And it's not necessarily going into those and winning them. It's going into those and surviving them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you often hear this with MMA in particular. People will say, I've got massive respect for anyone with the guts to step into the cage, right? It's not whether they won or lost. It doesn't matter if you've got a really good record. What matters to earn that respect is that you've faced that challenge and you've almost conquered yourself, right? That's the sort of idea. So that's kind of what edge work leads us to analyze, right? It's a motivation to push yourself to the absolute limit to see if you've got what it takes to continue to survive. I don't think this necessarily describes all of MMA. I don't think every person who enters a cage necessarily does so with those motivations, but I do think there's some value in it. If you look at a lot of the ethnographic research, tried to do in that paper, tried to apply that theory sort of post hoc to others' data, and I think it does fit quite well.
Yeah. When I first saw the title of that paper and it said Edgework, I thought it was going to be a paper about your current or your most recent research on the kind of the corner medics in boxing matches, because I just thought they're at the edge. But so tell us a bit about your interest in the doctors and medics who monitor combat sport events.
Right. So actually in the paper, there is a little bit of that data. I wrote it while we were still gathering the data, so it wasn't a report per se. But yeah, that's the study that I've done again with good old Chris Matthews. He and I collaborate maybe a little bit more often than we should. I don't know. And Matty Hillier as well from Leeds Beckett. And we carried out a research project over about 2 years, of course, about 2 years of data gathering, visiting mostly mixed martial arts events, fair few boxing and kickboxing events as well, and a couple of BJJ tournaments. Yeah. And we were specifically interested in the medics that work there, who they are, how they get hired, who they report to, if at all, what kind of procedures they follow, what regulations they have to adhere to, if any, you know, basically how they actually go about doing their work on any given night. And for those folks who are familiar with the combat sports scene, the full contact combat sports scene, it's not particularly well regulated in the UK. We don't really have, we in boxing we do, we have governing bodies that are fairly well established. England Boxing for the amateur stuff, and then the British Boxing Board of Control for professional fights. But we still have boxing events that go on without those bodies overseeing them, right? White collar boxing is a good example of that. Plenty of that goes on and it's not overseen by anyone. Yeah. There are no credible governing bodies in kickboxing. There are governing bodies, they do claim to govern, but they don't actually govern. They don't have teeth to govern, right? They don't have any ability to enforce their authority. So they set rules for championship matches. If you want to fight for an ISKA belt, ISKA, you know, you fight under these rules. If you wanted to fight for this belt or that belt, you'd fight under those rules. They don't actually have any sort of direct control over what promoters do. So they don't run events. They don't stipulate, you know, how many people you're allowed in the arena. They don't stipulate, you know, who the medics are going to be, when they do their checks, how they do them. There's none of that at all. And it's the same in mixed martial arts as well. It's largely run on sort of individual promoters making up as they go along is probably the best way to describe it. Now, we do have a group, I should say, called Safe MMA in the UK, which some folk might have heard of. And they do a pretty good job of setting a kind of a gold standard they want doctors to work to. But again, they're not a regulator. They can't enforce what they're saying, what they want you to do. So it's a voluntary thing for promotions to sign up to. The big promotions sign up to it. So the UFCs, Bellator, Cage Warriors, they follow Safe MMA guidelines. But yeah, smaller promotions largely don't, and there's no compulsion for anyone to anyway. So if tomorrow Bellator decided they didn't want to play Safe MMA regs anymore, there'd be no one forcing them. So we've got a situation in the UK where it's one promoter described it to us as pretty much the Wild West. You've got a lot of good guys out there, but you've also got a lot of outlaws, and they do what they want and no one will stop them.
So what would it take for there to be to really properly be national governing bodies of certain forms of different types of combat, the way that they have in countries like France and Germany? They you know, you have to be regulated all the way through. Do you think that's are there downsides to that, to regulating everything, or and how, would it be possible in the UK, or are we far too chaotic and I don't know, chaotic and individualist to make that happen?
It's a good question, and I wish I had an answer to that. I really do. I think you're right to say that we're a little bit too chaotic at the moment. There's just too much going on. There are too many people who are well enough established in their own little patches, their own little fields, to be made to just give it all up voluntarily. I think that if mixed martial arts had been given Olympic recognition, and they've been pushing for this, the IMAF have been pushing it for a while. If and when they manage to get that, that might give some impetus, because then if we have a British mixed martial arts team, that would be under, you know, it would be a Team GB thing, it would come under the auspices of UK sport, and there'd be a reason then, because money would be attached to it, like Olympic money, public money for training and so on would be attached to it, much like it is with England boxing. That wouldn't guarantee that you'd see all of the, you know, the other characters disappear, because like we're saying, in boxing, we've got those bodies, but they still have, there's a sort of massive blind spot where they don't regulate. Another thing to keep your eye on, I mean, there is actually, I should also mention, a recently formed, about a year ago, English Mixed Martial Arts Federation, which I think sort of come about out of the ashes of the UK Mixed Martial Arts Federation, which didn't really get off the ground eventually after a few years of trying. Yet to see really what kind of impact they'll have. There's some big names involved, you know, people who have been around in the sport for a long time, who are well respected, but no teeth still. So I think until you can put money into it, or you can put some sort of penalty. I hate to say it. I'd like to make things all punitive and disciplined and whatnot, but yeah, there's no incentive for a promoter to align with regulation A, B, and C. Then they're not going to. So I think it's a long road ahead. Okay. Maybe one other thing to not drone on too long about this, but folk who are interested in sport policy, you'll probably want to have a look at CIMSPA, the Chartered Institute for the Management of Sport and Physical Activity.
Okay.
In relatively recent development in the UK over the last few years. And I know about CIMSPA through higher education, actually. We're trying to get our courses all accredited by them to give our graduates a little sort of badge of honor when they graduate. And CIMSPA are very interested in martial arts, given the quite a high number of safeguarding cases over the last few years have been, you know, shone a pretty bad light on some sports, as well as the general lack of regulation that goes on across them. So they are on, you know, martial arts is on super sports radar as something that needs to be addressed. How they'll do that exactly, I don't really know yet, but that's something to look, to have a look at.
Okay, so it sounds to me like the relationship between your teaching and your research is quite a kind of intimate one, isn't it? That it overlaps in lots of ways, but you go off in different directions with your research, and then you'll have to go in certain directions with your teaching. What are the next? What are your next stages either for your martial arts in the teaching? Because it's not a very commonly instituted thing in Britain, is it? There's not that much taught academic university level martial arts studies or anything like that, is there? So I guess the question is, what are there any developments in terms of your discipline there, and I guess your next stages for your research?
Yeah, so with the teaching, I'd love to get it going again. So I didn't manage to recruit students last year. It's, you know, it was an optional elective module. You're always at the sort of the mercy of a minimum number signing up to make it.
You need a sexy title. It needs a sexy title. You need to really get the cool terms out there front and centre.
Yeah, I think I know why I didn't sign up. It's lack of presence in front of the second years, I think, to really set it and drive it home. But
they didn't know who you were, Yeah.
Hopefully we'll be back on next year. I've really enjoyed teaching that. It's a nice opportunity to spend an hour or 2 hours a week nattering on about things that I really enjoy, or doing some training. That's lovely when you can wrap your job up like that. So I'd love to get back to that and continuing to keep that module sort of fresh and relevant to the evolving needs of training PE teachers, I think, is definitely on my radar. Mm-hmm. Research-wise, the Fight Doctors study, it's something that's got a fair few more things to say about that. Just had a paper accepted last week to do with power relations for how people figure out, if you're in a institution where there's no guarantee that you have any authority, how do you convince people to go along with you?
Okay.
What do you do to earn status and respect in that field? So that was quite fun to write. There's a few more things to say, I think, out of that study intellectually before we put that one to bed. And I'm also quite interested in referees, actually. I met a few really interesting characters during the course of doing this study, interviewed a few and got some great data there. So trying to formulate maybe a larger research project around the role of the referee and how the referee learns their craft, how they employ it to protect fighters, to protect the sport, reputation of the sport, and so on. So yeah, those are on my radar.
Okay. That's excellent then. I guess we leave it there, I think. It's going to be very enjoyable. The internet's going a bit wobbly. I've had some dodgy times with the internet as well, but it was really nice talking to you, Alex. It's
lovely
to see you again, and I hope we see each other face to face in a real kind of way soon.
Absolutely, me too. Thanks for having me on.